Welcome to Talkless Water, the podcast that takes a deep dive into the world of water with those making waves. My name is Todd Bodler, and I'm your host for Talkless Water. I'm also the principal of Collaborative Water Resolution, which you can find at waterdisputes.org. In addition, I'm editor-in-chief of Texas Must Water and the Texas Water Journal. Both publications are free. My guest today is Brian Richter. Brian has been a global leader in water science and conservation for more than 30 years. He's the president of Sustainable Waters, a global organization focused on water scarcity challenges, where he promotes sustainable water use and management with governments, corporations, universities, and local communities. Previously, he served as director of the Global Water Program at the Nature Conservancy, an international conservation organization. Brian has consulted on more than 170 water projects worldwide. That's a large number. He serves as a water advisor to some of the world's largest corporations, investment banks, and the United Nations, and has testified before the U.S. Congress on multiple occasions. He teaches water sustainability now at the University of Virginia. Gosh, that's a whole lot, Brian. But thank you and welcome to Talkless Water.
Hey, Todd, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, I've been looking forward to this, as you know, and you know, we were going to talk earlier, and then this got moved back to summer a little bit, but you know, this, the timing is really good, I think. And so let's start out so that everybody kind of knows what first got you interested in water, and how did you decide that, hey, I'm going to spend the rest of my career on water?
Yeah. Well, I think the first inklings, Todd, were actually all the way back when I was in high school. I grew up in Southern California. I grew up in San Diego. And even back then, we were having mandatory water conservation imposed upon, you know, the people living there in the city of San Diego. And I remember having this odd thought at such a young age that if I could become an expert on water, that I would always have job security. And that certainly has played out to be true.
Right.
That thinking was really reinforced when I started graduate school. I started graduate school thinking I was going to go into wildlife ecology. But that summer, I became a whitewater rafting guide in the Sierra Nevada. And the river that I was rowing was the Stanislaus River, comes off the west slope of the Sierra. And during that summer, I learned that they were going to build a big new dam on the Stanislaus River that was going to completely bury, inundate that stretch of water that we were running. And I got so energized dismayed about that, that I just started reading everything I could about water. And that's how it all took off.
Huh. It's interesting. You know, that's how I really got into water as well, in some ways. I mean, concerning a water project, a reservoir that was going to be south and east of Dallas that was going to end up flooding an area of wetlands that were special area of bottomland hardwoods, which, you know, there weren't a whole lot of those in that part of the state that were left anymore. And, you know, that kind of ended up leading to a whole bunch of other things in the water world for me. So,
Yeah.
So now tell us about Sustainable Waters, Sustainable Waters, right? With an S.
Yes. So after I left the Nature Conservancy back in 2017, I knew that I, you know, wasn't going to retire at that point. I knew that, you know, I still had a lot of energy to work on water issues. And the one thing that really, I think, attracted the most of my attention during the time I was leading the Global Water Program for the Nature Conservancy were issues of water scarcity, where water shortages were having some really, you know, in some cases, horrendous impacts on local people, on river ecosystems, and that sort of thing. And so I decided to start my own organization that I call Sustainable Waters. And basically, I've been able to work on two different sort of parallel and complementary pathways. One is education. So as you mentioned in your introduction, I've been teaching at the University of Virginia. I enjoy that a great deal. And it keeps me fresh, and it keeps me it keeps me current with all the things that are happening with water shortages around the world. And the other thing is consulting. You know, I basically operate a consultancy where I advise, again, as your introduction said, I advise corporations, cities, farming districts, other conservation organizations, and that sort of thing. But it's all pretty acutely focused on water scarcity problems. And even though I worked all around the world during my time with the Nature Conservancy, I worked in 40 different countries, my focus has largely been coming back home now to the Western U.S. And as you very well know, Todd, there's no shortage of work and water shortage problems to be focusing on out here in the West.
Right, right. Boy, you know, talking about job security, you mentioned at the beginning there. Water issues, water scarcity, challenges, all that. That is job security, I think, and something that's not really too vulnerable to AI. I mean, I was thinking about this, how expertise is in certain fields, you know, maybe the one thing that's eventually, you know, not going to be dominated by AI. And
that's a really interesting thought. It's very complex, as we know. It's very nuanced. It's very localized and it's very personalized. And you really have to get a good reading on the local situation and the people that are being affected by or creating, you know, the problems there to really understand. Right. So that's a very, very good point.
And a lot of it is understanding the personalities of the individual players.
Yes, absolutely. It's I think, you know, ultimately, it's very difficult to force people to do something, you know. Not to say that regulatory policies aren't a really, really important part of our, you know, of our toolbox of water strategies. But you know, even regulatory policies, I think, really need to be shaped with a great understanding of the people that are going to be affected by them. And so that's why I say water, managing water or trying to regulate water is a very, very personal thing. And you really have to understand what the concerns are of the local communities, because it is always, you know, a very, very local issue. And you have to understand what they're willing to do. You have to understand what they're concerned about, what they're worried about, and try to tailor solutions to things that they're not just going to understand and they're not just going to accept, but rather that hopefully, you know, they'll want to participate to make the situation better over the long term.
Right. Right. I remember my mentor is a professor named Joe Moore, and he was involved in the early 60s with water planning in the state of Texas and changes to the state's constitution having to do with water management. And I remember, you know, this is before I became, you know, more engaged with what the state legislature was doing. But I remember him telling us how, well, you know, we have this act that does this or that with regard to water in the state. And, you know, you may wonder why it was set up this way. Well, it was set up this way because this senator and this other senator didn't get along, and this was their compromise because they didn't want, one person didn't want this, the other person. And so, you know, it's some of that stuff, right, that ends up creating a system that, you know, people decades later, they're, you know, they run into an issue and they, you know, they first thing you might wonder is, okay, why was this set up originally the way it is? Well, sometimes it's that kind of thing, right? It's not really logical. It's not based on some, you know, the geographic issues, which are most significant, or the hydrologic issues. It might be a personality related thing.
Yes. Yes, it sounds like we both had some pretty effective or influential mentors. A quick anecdote. Mine was a brilliant water attorney by the name of David Harrison, working out of Colorado. And he was a terrific negotiator. And during the midst of a pretty tough discussion with some governmental agencies, he took me aside in the hallway and he said, "You know, Brian, you're never going to get what you want unless we can figure out how to get them what they need." You know, and it just said everything, right? To make your point. Yeah.
Yeah, I can tell you, you know, last night I was until about 11, I was east of Austin, you know, maybe about an hour east at a meeting, groundwater conservation district meeting, where there was a hearing as part of the meeting over a new permit. To withdraw water from that aquifer. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion, a lot of pushback from folks who'd shown up at the hearing. And you know, the same thing, you know, was kind of something was rolling around the back of my mind, you know how the folks who were concerned about the permit that might be issued and the people applying for it, how can they find some common ground to make sure they each get what they need. And yes. Is that possible? Yeah, I guess it's not always possible. I'm sure your mentor told you that as well, but yeah, but that's maybe where there's a potential solution when you can find a way to do that.
You bet.
So tell us about the actual trip, where you started and ended and some of the details of your rafting trip down the Colorado River. This is, you know, it's a long, winding introduction, right? to this part, which is really the start, which is, you and I had been, emailing back and forth over the last couple of years, having to do with a journal article. And you mentioned you're going to go rafting down the Colorado. And I thought, oh, okay, I want to really hear about your trip and then get your perspective on these different issues affecting the Colorado River, because boy, talk about dominating the news cycle for water. So start off with your trip. Where'd you go? What'd you do? What are some of the details of that?
Yeah. So Todd, I just mentioned a little bit ago that I was trained to run whitewater, in a boat, you know, many, many, many decades ago. And I've been doing my own trips, you know, with friends, rowing my own boat and running all kinds of rivers for, you know, for more than 40 years now, I guess. But the one thing I always dreamt of doing was to go down through the Grand Canyon in a wooden dory boat. And so it was the first time I ever paid anybody to take me on a river trip, and it was worth every penny. We spent 17 days on the river. We put in at Lee Ferry, which is right below Glen Canyon Dam, and floated 225 miles downriver to a takeout point called Diamond Creek. And God, there's so many rapids in between there, 90-something major rapids, I think.
Wow.
And some real hellbenders in there. But a glorious trip. It was 16 friends, mostly couples. And we essentially had the whole trip to ourselves and full attention from the guides. And these guides were gods. You know, I can't think of a better word to describe them, Todd. They, in fact, just one of the guides had turned 71 on the trip. And it was his 152nd run down the Colorado. So,
oh my gosh.
And it turns out that besides that, he's got a PhD in geology and he's the leading authority on the geology of the Grand Canyon. So that's that's the kind of experience we had.
That's you hit the jackpot there.
Boy, I tell you.
So tell me, a wooden dory boat, right? Was everybody in one of those? I mean, I imagine there's not too many of those kind of rafting trips down the Colorado that aren't, a raft.
Right. Yeah. So So the dories didn't really carry hardly any gear. All of the passengers, you know, got to ride in a dory boat. So there's four dory boats, four of us in each of the four dories. And all the gear got carried along by three big rubber rafts. So there were three young adults who got to row those boats behind us. And, but we got to experience a dory boat, which is a completely, it's a very different experience from running whitewater in a raft. It's a little bit unsettling. The positives are they're extremely fast. They're extremely responsive. They spin on a dime. It's like a Ferrari in the river, right? The downside is that they're kind of, they're quite vulnerable. I mean, one, wood doesn't respond well to being slammed against a rock. So
right.
You couldn't touch any rocks, you know, under the boat or next or on the side of the boat or whatever. The other is that there's not a whole lot of what we call freeboard. Height between the side edges of the dory, of the wooden dory boat, and the water level. There's only like at best 12 inches and sometimes only 6. And you get into that big sloshing white water and the water's coming over the boat and filling up the boat. And then the boat becomes like a floating full bathtub, you know, at times, and you have to bail it all out of there as quickly as you can. So it's a very different experience than what, you know, any of your listeners that have been in whitewater rafting boats, the rubber rafting boats, you know, it's a very, very different experience from that.
So were you also like trying to go down, I guess, some of the same stretch or the same stretch that John Wesley Powell did or anything like that? Or was, I'm just curious if that had any tie into what you're trying to do.
Well, it was definitely one of the key, it was the most challenging stretch of what Powell and his crew ran, of course. There are no comparable rapids. There's some big rapids in what's called Cataract Canyon, upstream of the Grand Canyon and upstream of Lake Powell. But you know, the Grand Canyon is got the big, you know, the really, really big water. And so it was the most challenging part of Powell's trip. He even had a couple of his crew decided, you know, halfway through the canyon to bail on the trip. They hiked out. They left the boats. Oh. They left the party and they climbed out of the canyon and got away. They were so freaked out by having to deal with that very, very frightening whitewater.
They climbed out into the middle of the desert or something.
Yeah, pretty
right?
much.
I mean, huh?
Pretty much. Yep.
So this year, I guess releases were down from what they would normally be, I'm thinking. And how did that affect, you know, the rapids that you encountered and I guess the pace of the trip?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was definitely much lower water. We ran this last September in October. And one of the really interesting things is that all of that water that flows through the Grand Canyon is being released by Glen Canyon Dam. And usually the dam is so full and the release outlets are near the bottom and the water is typically darn near
really
icy cold, very, very
yeah.
cold. You know, anywhere between 42 and 46 degrees, just to give your listeners some sense, and which creates its own hazard if you get dumped out of the boat, right? You can go hypothermic pretty quickly. Well, it turns out that Lake Powell, which is backed up behind Glen Canyon Dam, is so low that the water has warmed up so much that the water being released from those outlets now is 20 to 25 degrees warmer. So that was a very, very different experience to be running it, you know, in warm water rather than frigid cold water. The other was that the low water levels definitely present some challenges, particularly for certain kinds of boats. I mentioned that wooden dories don't like rocks. And so there were some rapids that were getting to be pretty shallow and pretty difficult for these guys to really navigate through them. And there was some fear that this year, 2023, was going to be even worse and might have caused the Park Service to rescind some of the river running permits for the Grand Canyon this year. As it turned out, we got a monster snowpack in the Rockies. A lot of snowmelt water came down into Lake Powell, and they've been releasing pretty normal flows now again.
So the releases have been, I guess, relatively normal this year because the anticipation of the increases in the reservoir because of the snowpack. But they're not in a situation where they're like, the level of the reservoir is so low, we're not even going to make our normal releases.
They kind of split that, that volume in two ways. You're absolutely right that they wanted to capture and hold as much water to rebuild the level, the storage in Lake Powell. But at the same time, they've got to release, enough water to get downstream and actually get all the way into Lake Mead down below the Grand Canyon, because there's so many people in what we call the lower basin of the Colorado that are dependent upon that water. So they kind of had to divide the bounty a little bit, so to speak.
Gotcha. So you were, on this rafting trip during a period when there's a whole lot of uncertainty about the future of the Colorado River. So tell me a little bit about that. Were you, during your trip, having discussions with any of the folks who are with you, or even some of these guys that sound like who are so familiar with these water issues? What'd you come away thinking?
Well, it's a great question, Todd, because, I was pretty emotionally distraught. I have to admit, here I am in the most sublime beauty that one can imagine. It's just, it's just relentless beauty, floating through the bottom of the Grand Canyon on that river. And yet I was almost constantly troubled by my knowledge that that experience might not be available for all that much longer. If the sort of dry periods return, and everybody, expects that to be the case, and we're living with climate warming and reduced flows into the Colorado River system now, we do expect that it's going to be lower and lower flows, less and less water available in that river system, coming through that river system in the next couple of years and decades. And so, knowing that we were getting so close to that moment where they might actually have to start shutting down that experience because of such low water, that really got to me. I have to say, there were times when my friends would look at me and say, "What's wrong?" And I realized, my body language must have been signaling, that sort of psychological distress that I was going through. I'm glad that they've got a little bit of a reprieve, but as well as I know that, if you don't take advantage of a water crisis to put into place the kinds of water policies and regulations that are needed, then you've missed a giant opportunity. It's not the only time that we get water policy advances or improvements, but we're both scholars. We're both kind of historians on water policy and how it's changed. And we both know that much of that has happened when things got really, really dire, when things were really, really bad. Then finally, the appropriate water policies reforms get put into place.
Absolutely. And I've been thinking a lot about that with regard to the Colorado, and I have a lot of listeners in Texas. So I have to make sure they, this week we're not talking about the Colorado and Texas, but, what I'm wondering is the agreement that has been reached is just a temporary agreement. I guess it's a 3-year reprieve, where everybody's going to try to cut back on their water use overall from the Colorado by, I don't know, the lower basin states are going to try to get to what, 10% cutback or something of that nature. But, after that, they're back at, ground zero again. And so I'm wondering, have you heard that they that they have something specific in mind that they're trying to get put together over the next 3 years? Or are we looking at a situation potentially where, okay, this 3 year reprieve's run out. Now we've got to pick up where we left off and figure out what to do? Or, I mean, what have you heard any whisperings about that?
Well, it's intense negotiations right now, and it will be for the next 3 years because some of the key agreements expire at the end of 2026. So the people who are responsible representing each of the respective seven states that share that river basin in that water, you know, they've all got their representatives that are there kind of, you know, fighting it out for, you know, to get the best deal they can for their respective states. You know, it's interesting. The recent agreement, the one that you're referring to, was just agreed to, you know, a few months ago. And essentially, the states in what we call the lower basin, there are four states there, California, Nevada, Arizona. I'm sorry, there's three states. Yeah, California, Arizona, Nevada. Those states agreed to try to find some way to cut their water use by 1 million acre feet per year, a total of 3 million acre feet over about 3 years. And they're getting amply compensated for it. The federal government is giving them $1.2 billion to help them, you know, figure out how to do that. Anybody who's been paying attention to the math of the water budget in the Colorado River system and how it's changed over time because of climate warming knows that that's grossly inadequate to really deal with the situation. And just so that your listeners really understand, in 3 out of 4 years since the year 2000, we've consumed more water out of the river than came down through the river system that year. So we have been overusing. We have been, you know, overdrafting that water account persistently for more than two decades now. And that's caused, to make up the difference of the overuse, they take water out of these big reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell. And so because they keep going back and hitting that savings account, the water levels in those two reservoirs have dropped very, very severely. At the end of last year, they were 3/4 empty. And so, and very close to a real crisis situation, our own day zero on the Colorado. And so there needs to be drastic reductions. Maybe that's the wrong word to use. There need to be substantial reductions made in how much water is getting used. And so far, the states haven't been willing to go nearly far enough in their commitments to those savings, Todd. And so the deal that was recently struck was about, you know, maybe a quarter to a third of what's necessary. And so, and it's only going to run, as you said, through 2026. So it begs the question of what then, right? What then for the longer term? And I think just about everybody's interested in kind of a long-term solution. We're all getting quite fatigued about, you know, just trying to make these incremental adjustments, you know, year after year after year. It's been very, very tiring and exasperating for a lot of us. And so there needs to be a grand bargain struck. And right. We don't quite know what's on the table right now. It's very, very hush-hush. But at the very least, a lot of us are praying that there will be a commitment to get the water use down to the level that the river is delivering, get that in balance, and also have the conditions within that agreement that acknowledges that we're going to have less water in the future years and decades. And so whatever they agree to has to be able to ratchet down as there's less water available. You know, they need to be responding to this changing baseline over time. So, a lot of us are on the edge of our seats watching to see what they come up with. And there's, you know, there's a lot of conservation organizations and academics that are offering their thoughts on this matter, but we don't really know what's going on behind those closed doors right now.
So you and I have spent a lot of time thinking about water markets.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm finishing up a study right now and going to be publishing a couple of articles, I think, or at least submitting a couple of articles to publications here probably this fall. And, you know, I keep looking at those issues on the Colorado and thinking, gosh, you know, it really cries out for a market-based solution. But, you know, I'm not sure those states can get there unless, like you say, you know, they're kind of forced to do something radical. And, you know, the situation may emerge where they are because, you know, this drought, may not be over out in the Western U.S. and they may, you know, see a situation where, okay, we had a temporary reprieve because of all the snowpack, in 22-23, but that's gone. And now we're really in it again. And, you know, just thinking about the water use and how the water is used out there, gosh, so much of it goes to really low value agricultural crops. And, you know, I'm very sensitive about the need to maintain, a robust, agricultural sector in a lot of these places. Even the Rio Grande, the Edwards Aquifer here in Texas, where you know you might argue that maybe some of that might be better in places that get more rainfall. But still, you know, it's important, and there are ways to do that. You know, to make sure that those parts of the economy in those regions and those watersheds can continue to thrive, but do so in a way that they're using less water and they're really, you know, devoting the water they have to maybe higher value agricultural products. Obviously, there's a lot in the news just again this last week, I think, about the, you know, growing of all this alfalfa in Arizona. A lot of it, or maybe all of it, I think all of it maybe, on groundwater that is, being shipped to Saudi Arabia. And, you know, the fallacy of using groundwater in that place for that crop. Hmm. What are you thinking in that regard? To me, that's pretty obvious. You look at that, you look at it, how much of this water from the Colorado is going for low value ag. What do you think?
Yeah. So yes, you've laid out a lot of the facts correctly there, Todd. So just a quick recap on the Colorado. So about more than 70% of the water use in the Colorado goes to irrigated agriculture, and more than half of that agricultural water goes to growing cattle feed crops, alfalfa and other grass hays. Okay. So that is the situation. That's the context. The remaining water use by cities and industries has been tightened up a lot. By the way, this will be, you know, a way of advertising. I published a paper this year about the cities that are using the Colorado River, and they've done some miraculous reductions through water conservation to really substantially reduce their total volume of water use, even while their populations have grown at a brisk pace. So there's not a whole lot of water savings that you're going to get out of the urban and industrial areas anymore. So we have to be looking at the irrigation water and how water is being used for irrigation. Ultimately, and I would say this not just for the Colorado River, but I'd say it for Texas and, you know, pretty much all of the Western states are in a similar situation where we cannot continue to produce the same amount of crops of the same type of crops going into the future. That is not sustainable any longer. So we have to make some big adjustments out in the agricultural landscape. And, you know, and people talk a lot about improving irrigation efficiencies. I've written about that. There are some real challenges in trying to make sure that that water is actually getting saved, because what happens in a lot of cases is the water saved by one farmer is just taken up by, you know, the farmer next door.
Right.
There are two ways that we've really advocated, and we have a big new paper coming out very, very soon that really highlights these.
Tell us where it's coming out.
Well, hopefully it's going to come out in a fairly new journal called Nature Water. But I'll keep you posted on that. These papers I make available, either the links or the papers themselves, through my website, which, you know, we'll make sure everybody hears that or can find that. But so two things have to happen. One is that the total area of irrigated farmland has to shrink to some degree, maybe 10-20%.
Right.
This is true not in the Colorado, not just in the Colorado, but in the, you know, in the Central Valley of California and up in the Snake River Plain in Idaho, and, you know, on and on and on. So we're going to have to reduce the overall irrigated acreage, and hopefully that land that goes out of production, that those lands can be targeted in a planned, intentional way, so that we're not losing the most productive farmland. Hopefully it's the most marginal farmland that goes out of production. And hopefully also we find good new purposes. We call it land repurposing for the land that goes out of production, whether it goes, you know, under solar glass, or whether it goes into, you know, wildlife habitat or what have you. You know, hopefully we can figure out some way to do that in the best way, in the optimal way possible, is to take some land out of production. The other big thing that needs to happen is we need to start growing a different mix of crops.
Right.
We need to start growing crops that require substantially less water, but to your point about the value, but at the same time, keep the farmer's revenues, the farmer's income whole, or perhaps even improves it. And
yes,
this paper that I'm, you know, selling here, marketing here, that'll be coming out shortly, talks about that. You know, we did a deep analysis for six farming regions in the Western United States and looked at how you can change the mix of crops being grown. And by doing that carefully and selectively, you can grow crops that use a lot less water, but are much more valuable and therefore keep the farmers whole. Now, all right, so I'm quick to say, you know, before everybody says, oh, that's Pollyannish and, you know, that's, you know, there's no way in the world you're going to get enough farmers to do that. We thought very carefully about that. And it is a heavy lift. And I think there's going to have to be some real financial incentives made available to help the farmers go through those transitions and perhaps even learn how to grow different crops. But, and there has to be a lot of demonstration that they're going to be able to make the amount of money that they used to make by doing it. But those are two big things, Todd, that I think is going to have to happen across the West: reducing the footprint of irrigated agriculture, and then changing, you know, the mixture of what's been grown.
Right.
Up.
Right. You know, both of those have been accomplished in the water markets for the Edwards Aquifer and for the Rio Grande, for the middle and lower Rio Grande in Texas. And, you know, they did not require the second element, which was, you know, a lot of financial aid to the farmers and all. I mean, well, the way the markets were set up, you know, the farmers were able to start making money by, you know, leasing or converting some of their water rights to higher valued uses, to lease or to sell to municipal and industrial users. And you know, so obviously when I was doing this study, I, you know, couldn't keep focused all the time on, you know, the intended, you know, outcome, and started thinking, wow, you know, I'm getting all these great ideas. I'm going to make a straw man for a water market for the Colorado. And, you know, one of the first elements of that, I'm not going to go through all that, because, you know, I will be the first person to say, I know a lot less about the Colorado River out west than a lot of people, a lot. And so just saying that off, you know, from the beginning. But one thing that it does have that these other water markets have, and which I think you will, you know, that you understand is a foundational element, is a lot of the water is already, you know, devoted to low value ag rights, which, you know, are kind of the fuel for a water market. You know, so much water devoted to low value uses, which, you know, provide the, you know, the, well, it is, it's the fuel that the water market needs to go eventually.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, the thing I, you know, just kind of getting to the bottom line, you know, of a water market discussion is, you know, the thing that is a real issue, I think, is the public's fear and, you know, the participants' fear about what something like that would mean. Because, you know, you look at the big water markets, they, as you know, mentioned earlier, you know, they resulted from a big water crisis slash conflict, right? And something radical had to be done. And so the conflict is all up front, right? It's creating the thing and where you got to the point where you had to create it and what went through, what happened in the process of creating it. And then after that, you know, if you look at the Rio Grande, the Edwards, you know, there are transactions going on all the time. Nobody knows about it. There's no conflict associated with them because it was, they were set up really well. And so, you know, you have the users who are responding to, you know, how much water is available and what the demand for it is. And, you know, internally, those systems are really functioning well without that, the conflict that you see, you know, everywhere else, right? In the kind of these legacy systems we have. And so, so at any rate, I think, you know, that's part of the thing I'm watching is, you know, does it get to that point where there's has to be a radical solution where it's not really radical, but people think it's radical, right? Because you're changing a system that's been in place for a long time and it's got so much inertia associated with it.
Yes. And yes, Todd. And, you know, great point about how so much of the conflict is up front in the negotiation. And then a lot of times, you know, it gets normalized, it gets socialized. And people get used to, you know, operating under the new set of rules and scenarios. You know better than any of us about a lot of that initial conflict comes from the farming community, because that's where most of the tradable water is. And for the reasons that we just described, you know, with regards to the Colorado, and there is a great and legitimate fear in these farming communities that if too much water goes out of their local community, their local community culture, their local community economy, their livelihoods, you know, even if it's not them trading off their water themselves, it's all their neighbors are the ones doing the trading. It changes their communities. And there's a great fear about that. And I think a lot of communities and a lot of states have been pretty thoughtful about how to make those transitions without being as disruptive as some of the places that, you know, that we know, you know, where some bad things happened to local communities. But it's a visceral concern in these rural communities that their way of life and the community that they've lived in perhaps their entire lives is going to unravel, you know, before their eyes. So if we can find ways to really address that, and, you know, make sure that, you know, again, I go back to where we started, right? With, really listening to those concerns and those anxieties and talking about them and having those people who have those concerns be engaged in shaping the way that the water market system or whatever solution is designed is a really, really important facet of all of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one thing that I think complicates, you know, doing that is I think people, when they hear water market, they automatically think interbasin transfers and things like that. I mean, what I've, you know, been focusing on are, you know, designing markets that are, you know, self-contained, that are regional in nature. I mean, you know, the Edwards and the Rio Grande markets, you know, there are no exports or imports of water. And, you know, really that's the thing that I think it's important to see this, a change, a fundamental change in the way we think of water markets, from something that's going to export water out of basin or, you know, whatever, to something that is regional and reduces the need to import water, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
There are places in Texas I'm watching, I'm thinking, gosh, you know, if they had a water market there, they wouldn't need this interbasin transfer. And by the way, the water market changes their behavior towards water and how they use it, but the interbasin transfer doesn't do that. I mean, it just sustains the current system that they have, right? And their water use can just continue to be profligate because they have, you know, this new influx of water from some other basin.
That's very much the case in the Colorado River system. For example, the state of Arizona, instead of, you know, doubling down on conservation and thinking carefully about, you know, water trading, the first place that they go is, oh, we need to build a desalination plant down in the Gulf of California in Mexico and pipe desalinated water up into Phoenix. Or we need to reach out to the Missouri River system and build a pipeline to bring it, you know, hundreds of miles across the plains.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's been the history of water managers' nature to go to trying to fix the supply side, trying to enhance the supply side rather than working on, you know, smarter, more efficient, more conservative ways of using, you know, the available water supplies that are available locally.
Boy, I mean, one thing about our predecessors who were water managers is, boy, they had great imaginations and a lot of ideas. They did some, I mean, interesting things that we probably wish they hadn't done now. But, you know, in this research I've been doing, one of the things I decided to do is I'm going to go back and look at all these old water plans in the state. And of course, I spent a lot of time on a water plan that my mentor worked on, the 68 water plan in Texas, which, you know, had 12 to, it's, you know, here's a, here, it's a water plan that's, you know, it's like a 15 million acre foot water plant, right? Maybe a little bit more than that, actually. But there's not a whole lot of focus on the plan in about this, but 12 to 13 is an interbasin transfer from the Mississippi River, you know, below New Orleans to Texas, right? And so it kind of starts off, you know, that old joke about, you know, how do you become a millionaire? Well, first you get $1 million, right? And so it's almost like that. You know, how do you get a break?
Once you win the lottery.
Right. How do you get to provide 15 million acre feet of water? Well, first, you know, we get a pipeline coming from the Mississippi with 13 million acre feet. And then, you know, we do these other things, which are really hard. You know, that talk, like you say, it's going on again. You know, people are talking about bringing water from this place or that place, or, you know, massive desalination, which is, talk about expensive and energy intensive. And that doesn't even get to the biggest expense, which is building a pipeline and the facilities to pump all that water uphill to where you need it. Right.
That's right. Year after year after year. Energy costs.
Right. I mean, there are applications for desal, but, you know, this, you know, the idea that we're going to be able to do maybe what Saudi Arabia is doing, where they've got, you know, they've got money and a lot of energy. Well, you know, but not much water. And so, you know, that's a different equation for them.
Right.
But here the equation is quite different as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, what do you think is ultimately going to happen with the Colorado? If you're looking at your crystal ball, what would you think is going to happen?
Well, I think eventually they're going to do what has to be done. They being these negotiators. It's interesting that the fate of 40 million people, with respect to water security is in the hands of less than, when it really comes down to the negotiations, it might be less than 10 people, And even if it's their close advisors and that sort of thing, it's less than 100 people, right? The fate of 40 million, in the hands of 100 people, decision makers.
And let me just interrupt you. I just read something recently that one of the key people in California is in his 20s or something. And boy, I'm going to tell you, I envy that guy. I was like, gosh, wouldn't you love to be in that situation where you're in 20s? There's a lot of pressure, but, you're running with the ball, right, for your entire state and the most populous state. Sorry, go ahead. Enough
not to know what real anxiety is.
Well, there's an advantage of that, right? Yeah.
No, but to answer your question more directly, I do think that, again, because they have to, I think they're going to make the right decisions ultimately. And I just hope that, that a lot of us can assert ourselves by whatever means of communication to say that, darn it, we're tired of these incremental temporary fixes. This is no way to live. We want water security. We want sustainable water supplies or a sustainable water management system for the long term. And let's figure that out now. And let's put that into place now. And let's do it in a smart way that accommodates climate change, the realities of climate change. And let's be sure to also take care of those things that, have been largely overlooked in water negotiations up to this point. As you very well know, the environment has suffered greatly. We have been struggling for decades and decades to get enough water for the environment. And in the Western United States and in the Colorado River system in particular, the Native American tribes have really been slighted and not invited into those negotiating rooms, even though they arguably hold the rights to maybe a quarter of the river's water. So I just hope that this, we got three more years. It might be irrational to be hoping that they're going to work this out, but I sure am hoping that that's going to be the case.
Well, I'm with you on that for sure. I'm keeping my fingers crossed and sometimes when we get into a drought here in Texas and the legislature's about to meet and they're thinking about the drought, and they're thinking about what needs to be changed in terms of what we do with our water, I keep my fingers crossed that the drought doesn't end too soon.
Yeah,
that sounds terrible.
Right. It's kind of a good feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, the reality is I've seen a number of legislative sessions where, we had not a flood, but a lot of rain during the middle of the session. And the legislature said, we have other pressing needs and the water crisis is done for now. We just finished a session where fortunately that did not happen. And we passed a major new water bill that is going to go for a vote in front of the citizens of Texas in November to create a new $1 billion water fund to help for water infrastructure and new water supplies and a whole bunch of other things. And so that was a great result. If we'd had a deluge here in the middle of all that, I'm not sure where it turned out the way it did.
Exactly. No, it's very, very much the case. And that's why, it's funny that you mentioned how you feel kind of awkward, wishing that, the bad conditions persist. But it's because both of us understand, that it has to be bad enough you know, to sort of force, you know, the right things to be done. And so when the big snowpack came to the Colorado River system this year, I'll admit it here publicly for the first time, I was like, ah, darn, you know, it's going to postpone having to make the tough decisions, you know?
Bad timing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe not. Who knows? Maybe they'll, you know, they're engaged enough after the last year or two that the 3-year hiatus they have, that they will, you know, keep in mind, or I'm sure that they will, hopefully, that the situation could return to what it was just a few months ago and is likely to do so. And so, you know, we've got to be bold in what we're going to do, because the future demands that it, you know, whatever they do is bold. I really enjoy this, Brian. You know, I wish I, you know, had you on the podcast, you know, years ago. So final question is, how can listeners find out more about your work and where they can get your articles?
You bet. So the website is Sustainable Waters, all together, plural, sustainablewaters.org. And you'll easily be able to navigate to the list of publications, and many of them are downloadable very, very easily from there. And in terms of just, you know, learning more about the kinds of things that I have been working on and advocating for, I'm a blogger. I'm an irregular blogger, but there's a whole bunch of blogs that I've written up on that website as well. So if, you know, you might want to peruse through, you know, screen through them and see if there's anything of interest there.
And you can also sign up to get an email when you have a new one, I think.
That's right. That's right. On the opening page at sustainablewaters.org, you'll see a place that you can, you know, put your name on the list, and be happy to include you.
Good deal. Good deal. Well, hey, Brian, thank you for being on Talk with Water. I really enjoyed this, and we'll have to do this again, maybe after, you know, something significant has happened on the Colorado. We might get back together and kind of dissect that. But, you know, I really have enjoyed this.
Yeah. Mutual, Todd. It's always great to talk. We don't do enough of it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So I'm going to go ahead and read the closing stuff here and just tell everyone, or remind everyone, I guess, that this has been Talk with Water. And my guest today was Brian Richter, a global leader in water science and conservation for more than 30 years and the president of Sustainable Waters. I also want to thank you, the listener, for spending your valuable time on this podcast. And finally, I want to give a big thank you to Anna Huff at the Meadow Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University for getting each episode of Talk Plus Water ready to flow. Ha ha ha. At any rate, my name is Todd Butler. Let's talk water again soon.